We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about some of the problems and some of the challenges faced by the auto industry around the world. Certainly, the big news has been, recently, troubles at Toyota. This week, Toyota announced that it would recall over 400,000 Prius cars to address a problem with their braking systems. The company's image had already been suffering as the result of a recall announced back last November to try to fix a problem with sudden acceleration in some of its models. We'll try to talk a little bit about what's going on now in the auto industry, talk about what Toyota is doing to try to regain the confidence of consumers, and also what U.S. automakers are doing to try to recapture some of their lost market share. And our guest for the program is Bruce Belzowski. He is the Associate Director and Assistant Research Scientist in the Automotive Analysis Division's Industry Structure Group at the Transportation Research Institute at University of Michigan. He's authored research reports focusing on a number of automotive topics, including product development, manufacturer-supplier-dealer relations, and globalization. He's a frequent speaker on the automotive industry in conferences and in the media, as well as his testimony before the Congress. And he's joining us this morning by phone. We're pleased that he could spend some time with us. As we talk, questions are welcome, as always. If you are in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that, 800-222-9455. And we do also have possibility of email, so you may email your comments, questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Either way, questions are welcome. We do hope that people can try to keep them brief. That'll help us get in as many callers as possible, and certainly questions are welcome. Mr. Belzowski, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
No problem.
We certainly appreciate it. I don't want to end up spending all of our time talking about Toyota, but that seems because that's what's big in the news now, the place that makes sense to start. And just to talk a little bit about these, you know, to the extent that you can, about these two problems that the company is having. The first problem was this problem that in some models they are experiencing sudden acceleration. And it would seem that that's a mechanical problem, or at least the fix is mechanical. At the same time, as I have listened to a lot of the talk about this, I found myself wondering, do they really know what the cause of this problem is? And was this a manufacturing problem? Is it a design problem?
When you look at the way that they've been attacking the problem, it's more of a design rather than a manufacturing problem.
Mm-hmm. For the other problem, the braking problem seems to be, again, this seems to be, at least in the way they're addressing it, this seems to actually to be a software problem. It has to do with the fact that the braking systems on the Prius are really very complicated, and that, as I understand it, that over time what they've tried to do is actually make improvements in these, but now we have this particular problem that if the car is jolted for a short time, there's no brakes.
Right, that's what I've heard as well.
And so again, there you sort of wonder, well, is that the same kind of problem? Is that a design flaw? Is that a manufacturing issue, or is this just an artifact of an attempt actually to improve the system that they had?
I think it's more of a design flaw in relation to the electronics and the programming of the vehicle. Remember, there are probably, you know, the estimates of a million lines of computer code in each vehicle nowadays to allow the vehicle to do all the things that it needs to do electronically.
Mm. So here, I suppose the big question is that here we have a company that had enjoyed for a very long time the reputation of being a very well-made product, and now we have two problems that have come up. One could argue how serious they are, but we have two problems that reflect a lot of vehicles. what is the, as far as the company is concerned and what's going on at Toyota, what do you think the problem is?
Well, when you look at the problems that are showing up, they're typical recall type problems that are dealt with through the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, or NHTSA. And these are the kinds of problems. They're all safety related problems, and these are the kinds of things that trigger recalls. And it's not unusual for companies to have recalls. In general, every major manufacturer has recalls and has had recalls for many years now. It just so happens that and Toyota has had recalls before, where they've recalled hundreds of thousands of vehicles for sometimes minor safety fixes. In this case, we've got some situations, especially the sudden acceleration problem, which is a very dramatic problem, because examples of it on like cell phone calls and things like that, accidents that may have been caused by this, and deaths that mm-hmm. may have been caused by this, and those are very dramatic, and it makes the situation much more dramatic, as well as the number of vehicles that are being recalled. We're looking at estimates range. I've heard from 4 to 8 million vehicles globally that are being recalled for these problems. So it's very dramatic because of the situation, as well as for the number of potential vehicles that are involved in it.
So that makes it sound as if you're suggesting that not that the problems aren't serious, but that it wouldn't get the level of attention it is now if we're not talking about so many cars.
I think that's part of it, but I think it's also the drama of people dying. When Ford had their problems with their Firestone tires in the early 2000s, where people where the tires were blowing out at high speeds and people were driving off the roads and rolling over and dying, I mean, that was a very dramatic situation for Ford. They dealt with it in I could argue, in a very similar way to the way that Toyota has. They may have not responded a little quicker than Toyota has to this problem, but they used a very similar process.
Well, do you? I guess that leads to the question. I'd ask you to talk a little bit more about the way that Toyota has responded, and whether you think the response was quick enough and adequate to the scale of the problem.
The manufacturers usually work this whole process through the, as I said, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, or NHTSA. And they're usually not going to recall vehicles unless they're told that they have to recall vehicles, because it's a certain amount of admitting fault to a situation that they want to, and they want it to be shown or proven that they really have this problem. So NHTSA will work with the manufacturers and independently, trying to verify the complaints that they're getting on certain vehicles. They'll open up a case, and then they will use their scientists and their engineers to try to figure out is there something systemic in these complaints, or is it they just one-off complaints mm-hmm. that may be attributable to things other than a failure within the vehicle itself.
Toyota is now, at least for the moment, the number one car maker in the world, and rose to that point in 2008. Before that, for a very long time, it was General Motors. And I think that some people have looked at this and argued that the problems that we're seeing here are the result of Toyota's trying to expand, to grow too big, too fast. Now, already Toyota was a big company, but do you think that there's anything to that?
It's hard to say. I did some interviews with people at Toyota in Japan last month, and there was some intimation that there were some issues having to deal with, maybe not a transfer of knowledge that was not being made from engineers to engineers, which is kind of related to the need for speed, where you're looking at how quickly do you have to bring out new vehicles, and how quickly do you have to kind of blanket the globe with your vehicles. with a real drive by Toyota to do this. And in some ways, it's in conflict with their process. They've been building and designing vehicles for, 50, 60, 70 years now, so it's not like they've never done this before. Mm-hmm. But it's a matter of is it because, and I don't know if this is true or not, is it because that the work that they were doing in terms of trying to speed up the way that they either bring vehicles to market or actually spread out across the globe that caused some of this to occur? It's hard to say at this stage.
Yeah. And you sort of wonder what they were thinking at Toyota. They were already the second biggest car company in the world. They were highly regarded. Cars were very popular. They were selling everywhere. Why they would feel that pressure to do this, that is to broaden the number of models that they're making available. They obviously made a big commitment to the idea of the gas electric hybrid. Why they would have done this and taken the chance that there would be some problems?
Well, they grew up with they've learned the capitalistic system. I mean, they said that you either you grow or you die. That's kind of that's the way the market works. They want people. They want companies to continue to grow. They want companies to and if, especially if the companies feel like they have some momentum. If they feel that they're being successful and have been successful over a number of years, they say, why not? Why can't we continue to grow? And in the auto industry, it tends to be a pretty slow growth industry to start with. But for Toyota to grow globally as they have been, it was a good challenge for them. They saw it as an opportunity.
We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Bruce Belzowski. He works at the Transportation Research Institute at the University of Michigan, where he is associate director and an assistant research scientist in the Automotive Analysis Division's Industry Structure Group. And I thought we liked long titles here. We're talking here about the auto industry around the world, talking specifically a little bit here at the beginning about Toyota and some of the difficulties that they've had. But we'll talk about the U.S. automakers as well. And questions, as always, we're open to questions. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I suppose the question that, one of the questions that people are asking that we yet don't have an answer for is, in the long run, how this will affect the way people think about Toyota, the cars. And already there's been some anecdotal evidence, people deciding they don't want their Toyotas anymore. Some people saying, no, I think it's a good product. They're going to fix it, and then I'm going to keep driving it. Any feeling at this point about what this means for the company and how people think about it?
Well, the truth will be in the numbers when we over the next few months as we see the effect on sales. That will be the really true test. For us to say what is going to happen is something that I think is beyond our understanding. So what traditionally happens with recalls is that buyers tend to see recalls as the companies accepting that they may have made mistakes and that they're willing to fix them pretty quickly and respond quickly and fix them quickly and get the people back on the road.
So it really all depends on how they address the problem in a real concrete way, and I suppose that really falls on the dealers who do the servicing to do everything they can to solidify that relationship with the customer.
That's one piece of you're right. That's one piece of the puzzle. But the first piece is the manufacturers responding quickly and coming out with a fix that the dealers can then institute and implement. Mm-hmm. So I think that becomes it's kind of like a 1-2 punch for how to deal with recalls every manufacturer has recalls and. Some manufacturers have multiple recalls on one vehicle, so it's not unusual at all for vehicles to be recalled. They tend to be recalled almost exclusively for safety issues. There are other things that companies could recall them for, but usually it's for safety issues.
We have a caller. Let's bring them into the conversation here. Somebody on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. A question, but I've commented. I've owned pretty much I think the last car I bought that was not a Toyota was 1993, and I've owned several cars. And the Toyotas, I don't think I've ever had a Toyota that I didn't get a letter back from the company sometime during its life that said, come back and we're going to fix this thing. And, you know, to me, that kind of said, you know, it was, you know, a non-recall deal, you know. To me, it kind of says, you know, this is wrong, we're going to fix it. And I've had other vehicles that later, Chrysler in particular, I had a lot of trouble with, that I found out everybody else was having trouble with it. And the company just, you know, they weren't really interested in taking care of you without paying for it. And so that's always impressed me about Toyotas, and I just thought I'd make that comment. But my question was, what fuels the drive to have such high horsepower motors in cars in this country? I know for a fact, most people will never, ever use that much power, and it seems to me like we're just dragging around a lot of motor for no reason at all. I frequently will be driving, and people go, what's that horrible noise? Because I push the pedal down farther than anybody else ever does. You know, it seems crazy to me that you can build a four-cylinder motor that'll go way over the speed limit easily, but we got to have sixes that'll get up to whatever the car's governed at in seconds. That was my question for you.
Well, this is a U.S. in general has a really strong car culture going back many, 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 many years, right? At least to the 50s. And there's always been a need for a tradition of power in vehicles, and that the more power, the better. And in particular, that was because gasoline was relatively inexpensive. So the cost of driving a vehicle, power really didn't have any effect on the relationship and how much you were paying to drive the vehicle. But it's only since the first oil crisis was in the 1970s. There were two then, and those were really the first triggers to make people think twice about the cost of driving a vehicle that has a lot of power. Having said that, you can see the things that have been changing in the industry over the last few years. And we're just going to start seeing the effects of that probably in late this year and the beginning of next year. We're going to start seeing vehicles that with downsized engines compared to what we're used to. And what the manufacturers are doing is they're going to for example, if you had a vehicle that usually would have a six-cylinder, that vehicle will now have a four-cylinder with a direct injection and turbocharged engine. It will give that four-cylinder more power, but it won't be as powerful as it'll be close to as powerful as the six-cylinder vehicle, but it will use 10% less fuel. And that's the kind of the direction that all the manufacturers are heading right now, as well as going to hybrids and other alternative vehicles. But you'll see those across all the fleets probably within the next 2 to 3 years.
I guess my guess would be the only people that ever come anywhere close to that power is the people who review the thing, because, I mean, most people I know will never even floor the car unless they accidentally fall forward, you know? So, that just always baffled me. They even worry about it. Most people have no idea how much horsepower their car has, you know?
Today the vehicles are so much more powerful. I remember it was a couple of years ago where one of the magazines compared a 1968 Corvette versus a Honda Odyssey. And actually the Odyssey was faster than the 68 Corvette.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I want to thank the caller. Invite others, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And our guest in this hour is Bruce Belzowski from the Transportation Research Institute at University of Michigan. Well, this gets us into, for a second here, maybe let me ask a follow-up. An area that we definitely wanted to talk about, and that's where things are headed. And the question is, given that Americans do have this history of liking big, heavy, powerful vehicles, if the automakers offer smaller, more less powerful, more fuel-efficient vehicles, part of us knows that that's really what we should be doing, but that's our better nature. Will people actually buy those cars?
I think that you've hit the $100 million question there. It's something that the manufacturers are struggling with, as well as the federal government, because the federal government really wants to move people in that direction. If you look at the Cash for Clunkers program that took place last July and August, and here you were taking vehicles off the road that got worse fuel economy and replacing them with vehicles that have better fuel economy. It was a part of a dialogue and a process that the administration is trying to develop within the U.S. and the manufacturers, and there are regulations that are going to go in place. Like right now, the corporate average fuel economy for all the manufacturers all the manufacturers have to increase their fuel economy of their fleets by 40% by 2016. And that's part of a regulation that the federal government has instituted. Now, the corporate average fuel economy, or CAFE regulations, have been with us since the 70s. So it was just a matter of pushing the needle a little bit to force the manufacturers to build vehicles that will be more fuel efficient. The question becomes, how do people respond to these types of vehicles? And the manufacturers are working really hard to try, as I said, to try to put out vehicles that they may be just slightly smaller. There will be some vehicles that are just smaller, but their vehicle may be just slightly smaller. It won't be a dramatic decrease in all vehicles across the board. It will be an evolution where people will see different types of vehicles available. Maybe they have different capabilities, but they'll still have enough power to do what people want to do. So I don't think, especially as your previous caller said, the idea of having too much power in a vehicle is not uncommon. So that the vehicles that they'll come out with that will get better fuel economy will still have enough power for people to drive. It'll be a question of will people, when they start driving them, feel comfortable with them.
Mm-hmm. We have some other callers. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Also a Toyota ownership, in fact, quite a bit in the family. Now, what was it before? What was the year or something or other that they're going back to recall? How far back?
I think they're going back to 2001, 2002, I think.
Well, I hope not.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
I thought it was a little later than that.
It could be. You could be right.
Because I'm 2001, never got a letter from the customer service is incredible, our local service, and the reputation, I always get the letter. The dealers are always sort of on guard that, you know, that you would respond, that the service was great, and et cetera, et cetera. From my understanding, and I don't know whether other automobile, I think there's a few other, maybe Honda and a few other that do it, that actually track to the, you know, there are all a lot of component manufacturers, correct, that that they have that manufacture the various parts for these cars, and then they stream in and then they're put together. But from my understanding, that they're tracked to individual manufacturers. So whenever a problem comes up, it was my understanding that they could actually go to the individual manufacturers, or I don't know, whatever you have a term for them, to correct the problem. Is that correct or not?
I guess I'm not sure about your question. Are you talking about suppliers being responsible for the products that they're building for the manufacturer?
Right, right. That what happened is that there must be a number of different ones, certainly in different locations, and that way they could actually go right to there to eliminate the problem.
Absolutely. That's exactly what they would do. Yeah, but it usually tends to be the manufacturer's responsibility.
Yeah.
Because it's their design.
Yeah, that's true. But what I'm getting at is that it seemed to me that, you know, I own Fords and all that kind of stuff back in the day, and you had these problems, and I don't know whether they were able to track back to resolve that problem. You know, it might have been, not in this one, it seems, this was a design problem, but when it comes to these component manufacturers that they could actually get back to the one that had the problem. Is that correct?
I think they always could do that. I don't think there was ever really a problem. The manufacturers don't have too many suppliers for each component. They would only have, at the most, probably three or four, sometimes just one or two. So they always know where the parts were coming from. For example, in the Ford Firestone problem, they tracked that tire-making process back to, I think it was a place in Decatur, Illinois, a plant there, and that they were saying that they were making faulty tires. Well, it also came out that Chrysler had a faulty design for those tires, so there was enough fault to be shared between both groups. But even then, early on for the Toyota recall, there was some intimation that it was the Toyota supplier that was responsible for the flaw, when really, when you look at it, it looks like a design flaw. And that was designed by, and it was probably designed by Toyota, if not designed by Toyota, at least signed off by Toyota, so that they actually, you know, knew what the design was and then said, okay, yeah, this makes sense.
Well, what happened to some kind of early warning system then about this problem?
For
Toyota.
For Toyota, the only early warning system that's in place is really people who are calling into the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration saying, I got this problem with my car, and I can't, either they're not getting a response from the dealer, I don't seem to be able to get it fixed, they don't seem to be able to get it fixed, and I called and they don't seem to be responding. Sometimes, especially on safety issues, people will be calling in to NHTSA to say, hey, I got this problem with my car. And if enough of those calls come in, the NHTSA will end up opening a case and say, okay, let's take a look at this.
Was that done then, or what happened?
Yes, it was. Actually, for the sudden acceleration problem, Toyota had two different cases in NHTSA for two different vehicles over the last year and a half, at least, where they were brought in and examined, and in both times NHTSA cleared them, said that they couldn't replicate it, they couldn't verify that there was any fault in the system. That doesn't mean that there wasn't a fault in the system, but they just could not find it. So they ended up having to clear it and let it go. And this is not unusual for the manufacturers to be treated this way, and actually NHTSA is kind of getting called on the carpet right now by the Congress for saying, okay, you cleared this a couple times now, you know, how come you weren't able to sort it out? And one of the reasons is maybe it's not that simple to figure out. You know, the vehicles are so complicated now that maybe even the manufacturers and the government combined could not quite figure it out. You know, and it becomes an issue for the manufacturer if there are enough cases of this problem, and even if they really can't, you know, kind of pin them down and say this is a fault in your vehicle, manufacturers sometimes will say, hey, we're going to try to fix this anyhow. We're going to try this, and we're going to try that. We're going to try this because we think it's really important and so important from a safety perspective and for our reputation that we're going to try to deal with this as quickly as possible.
We have a number of other callers here, and we want to get on to the next, and that would be someone in Urbana and line two. Hello.
Hi. I own two Toyotas, one 91 truck and one 04 Camry. Four-cylinder, both. I haven't received. I bought my car locally here, and I haven't received any notices of recalls or intent to repair defects as yet. On my, I'm not too much concerned about my truck, but on my 04 Camry, and it does have a strange reaction to slick pavement. And I bought it back in 04. And back in November of 04. Nonetheless, my question about you, sir, is I notice you're based in the state of Michigan, and of course, you know, you are the capital of U.S. auto manufacturing. I'm wondering, you know, Toyota's been getting a lot of attention on the recalls. I'm wondering about comparable U.S. manufacturer defects. And the fact that I know I've heard something about Fords and their hybrids, and of course the numbers are not nearly as big. And so if the NTSB made their decision on the number of Toyotas out there, it's only because of their prior success in selling their product. I think they strayed from the course when they took more power out of the trucks. My 91 truck has more power than a 2010. And my engine in my Camry is a more powerful engine than the one in my truck. But the current truck engines are really puny. And I think they dropped the ball there. But nonetheless, I think I put enough on the table there. But it's Ford rather than Chrysler about the Firestone tires in Decatur, and they were putting it on one another. And I think before the Falcon, whatever defect you mentioned in Ford, there was another one. I think it was a Falcon that had an exploding gas tank before.
That was the Pinto.
That was the Pinto.
Okay, Pinto. Do we have any other American Pintos out there? And Toyota's hands aren't clean. So.
Yeah, well, as you say, you put a lot on the table. Mr. Belzowski, you can deal with
whatever. Well, the
first
thing you should do is you should call your dealer and see if your car is on the list to be on the recall list on the Camry to see if and make an appointment to get it fixed.
And I think also that if people go to the Toyota website, that I think also then they would see there a list of which models and what years are covered. But I think your advice is the sound thing. I mean, wherever you bought the vehicle from, you should call them.
Yeah, and see if they have the parts in place, if they're getting new parts to do the fixes. So if they're ready to do it and you're ready and you got the vehicle, you should probably take it in. So that's that issue.
Yeah.
The other issue has to do with the percentage or the number of complaints or recalls. There's a few different ways of looking at this story. One, you could look at the number of complaints that NHTSA actually gets. One, you could also look at the number of vehicles that are affected by a recall. You know, in the Toyota case, you're looking at potentially 5 to 8 million vehicles worldwide. That's a lot of vehicles. Or you could also look at the percentage of recalls that each of the manufacturers themselves have. Now, the numbers that I got some data, and this is off of Edmunds.com, and this is really only looking at the complaints, like the number or the percentage of complaints that NHTSA receives for each of the manufacturers as it compares to their market share. So meaning if you sell a lot of vehicles, you get a lot of complaints. And when you look at the list, and you can see it on Edmunds.com, Toyota, there are 20 major automotive manufacturers in the U.S., and Toyota ranks 17th in terms of the number of vehicles, the percentage of complaints that they have compared to their market share. So you can see most of the manufacturers are actually doing a little worse than they are on this scale. Now, the complaint story is a complicated one because are all the complaints real? Are there duplicates? You know, so it's not as clean a way of modeling or measuring. I guess one would maybe say the percentage of recalls that take place by the manufacturer and the number of vehicles that are recalled would probably be a better way of measuring. But this is what we have right now.
All right. And again, we will continue and talk with another caller here. And this would be someone in Urbana on line 3.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. A while back you were discussing increased fuel economy, the CAFE efficiency increase by, 2016?
Right.
Is this going to affect safety? Because that's always the thing the opponents of increased fuel efficiency bring up, that you decrease the size of the car and it becomes less safe. Is there any validity to their claim?
Well, that's always you're right. You're absolutely right. That is a very common and it has some truth to it, that if you get in an accident with a vehicle that's larger than you are, than your vehicle, and heavier than yours, you know, that you have a potential not to come out on the short end of that accident. It depends, you know, how you're hit and things like that. But in general, the laws of physics say that, you know, if you have a larger vehicle, you will come out ahead when you're going against a smaller vehicle. But as the fleet of vehicles continues to shrink over a period of time, vehicles will be more close, will probably be closer to each other in size and weight, except for there will always be in the U.S. market probably some larger vehicles and some very small vehicles, and that mismatch is probably the biggest problem in terms of accidents. But manufacturers are going to different kinds of materials. They'll go to more aluminum that will have a certain still the same amount of strength, but they'll be lighter weight. They may go to some composites. Plastics composites that will also have good strength and be lighter weight. So they're looking at ways of lightweighting the vehicle but still keeping it strong. So it's something that the manufacturers have been looking at this for years, but now because the cost of the demand to have their vehicles meet more stringent fuel economy regulations, they're more willing to look at some alternative materials than they were in the past.
Is there any hope for the use of the carbon
carbon element? Fiber?
Yes, fiber.
Carbon fiber is very expensive. I've seen some things where they're maybe doing it on certain components as opposed to a whole vehicle.
We just have about 10, 12 minutes left, and I have a couple of other callers I'd like to give them a chance to get into the conversation here, and also I should introduce the guest one more time. Bruce Belzowski works at the Transportation Research Institute at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He's associate director there, also an assistant research scientist in the Automotive Analysis Division's Industry Structure Group. He's done a lot of research on a number of topics, including product development, manufacturer, supplier, dealer relations, globalization. Does also speaks a lot in the media about the auto industry, and that's what we're talking about here this morning. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And our next caller is line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Oh, I missed the days of the old muscle cars. Gas hogs at their best.
They're still out there. We still have some.
I know. Well, gas hogs. But... gentleman brought up something I was going to bring up earlier, the carbon composite. I know that they've taken the car manufacturers have kind of taken kind of what a notch out of what NASCAR does is when you get in a wreck, they kind of just fall apart, you know, dissipate the energy, which is a good idea. But the problem is it doesn't take much to tow a car out, no matter what brand they are anymore. Lighter weight. I have an F-150, and you can – it's only a couple of years, you can actually lean up against it and put a dent in the fenders real easy. You know, you could, if you pounded on it with your fist hard enough, pretty good, you know, pretty husky guy could put a dent in it. Not like the old days where it'd take almost like a sledgehammer to put a dent in it. And a lot of the technology out there is wrapped around making cars lighter. Now, this is for a safety factor, I don't know if that's good or not, but it's kind of hard to have both safety and fuel mileage, because you're looking at, like you just said, you know, bigger cars against smaller cars. And for one thing, my mom's not going to give up her Cadillac. I know a friend of mine won't give up his SUV because they're really definitely afraid of getting in a wreck with people, that if you have a smaller car, you're going to end up coming out of it, you know, with a lot of bodily injuries and whatnot. Now, I think the car manufacturers out there are doing the best what they can. But, again, you know, people – I just tell people, buy what you think you feel comfortable with. Toyota has always been a good car. People are just getting freaked out about this a little bit too much, because I know Ford, Dodge, Chevy, they've all had the recalls in the past. In fact, I just got a recall notice for a vehicle I haven't had for 3 years, an Explorer. On the brake system, they could catch catch fire. I had a 94 Explorer, and I haven't had it for 2-3 years. So there you go. But the point being, you know, I think this whole thing with Toyota is kind of overkill. Now, did they do some illegalities by passing on? Sure, and I think they all do that. The thing people have to read is the fine print on when they buy a car. Extended warranties, I tell people constantly get extended warranty, because here I 2 years after my warranty went up, I had to replace the transmission in a 2005 F-150. Now, I've always owned Fords in my life.
Yeah, you've laid a number of things out for us to talk about, and I really need to jump in because, you know, time's moving along here, and I want to give the guest a chance to maybe say a couple things. Again, you can respond to whatever parts of that you'd like.
I think the safety issue is an interesting one, because even though cars may be developed and be a little lighter, the things that they have on vehicles now to make them safer, especially airbags, they have airbags, sometimes 6 to 8 airbags on the inside of each vehicle. And they also have different electronics that they have on vehicles to try to keep them from rolling over or flipping over in extreme circumstances. They call it electronic stability control. So there are a lot of electronics now that are used on vehicles as a way to try to keep the people, for A, from getting into accidents, and B, if they get into accidents, to have less injuries. If you look at the safety ratings for vehicles, that, again, the federal government does safety ratings, and so does the insurance industry on safety ratings on all vehicles, in general, vehicles do very well on all kinds of crashes. But you're looking at, they're usually talking about 30-mile-an-hour crashes, sometimes 40-mile-an-hour crashes, which it doesn't sound like a lot until you get into one of those accidents and you see how much damage can be done in those situations. But what ends up coming out of those is that people get very few injuries from those kinds of accidents anymore because of the safety that's been built into the vehicle. If you want to look a little farther out, there's new technologies that are being developed that look at being a little more proactive, so that the car will start sensing if you're in a dangerous situation. They may actually start braking or slowing you down, depending on how the car is seeing. They actually have vision, either radar or cameras around you in the vehicle, to actually see what else is going on and start making decisions for you if you're not making the right decisions. That's coming down the road. We'll see how that actually plays out.
All right. Got another caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've heard you say that people that have problems, they report them to NHTSA, and then when NHTSA gets enough of the same kind of problem, they investigate. Did I get that wrong or not?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, it seems
I don't
like...
know what the threshold is, though.
Well,
when do they start saying, hey, we got enough calls here, we got to see what's going on?
Well, it seems like you kind of describe an idealized world. If anyone has any questions, I would suggest through Hulu or however you can pull it up in the Internet, the news program that Diane Sawyer anchors last week ran several pieces. And one of the things they described, and I hate to give you something secondhand, was that this is the mid-2000s, and it's, of course, and a different administration, but one of the things that Toyota and NHTSA agreed to is to exclude high-speed, long-duration throttle stickage accidents. They threw them out.
I did see that. I did see that article.
And, of course, that would have included that accident last year where the state trooper and his, you know, his passengers were killed.
Right.
So in an idealized world, that there wouldn't be something like that. And I think anyone that has any questions ought to pull those news reports up and see them themselves, because what they did was they only included short duration, low speed throttle stickage problems, which of course would not, you know.
It affects some of the accidents, but not all of them. And I think that this is why I think NHTSA will be called on the carpet by Congress to explain why they did that.
Yeah, because obviously any accident that was a fatality sounds like it would have been excluded. And one more quick problem, question for you. I know you probably can't answer, but how far back do electronic throttles go? They aren't new, are they?
I don't know exactly when they started It is, I say, within the last 10 years.
Yeah, that's probably my guess. My first vehicles were 2000, GM vehicles.
My
throttles never had any problems, so they're not really that new.
Yeah, I think there's the. I think you bring up the question though of the sudden acceleration issue, and I think for anybody who's listening, there's a way of dealing with this, though you have to stay calm. And the trick is to put your foot on the brake if you have an automatic and put the car in neutral. If you really feel that the car is taking off on you and you don't have control of the accelerator, put it in neutral. The car will keep revving like crazy, but you'll be able to stop the vehicle.
Yeah, okay.
And I wanted to make sure I got that out before we got off the
sure.
air here, because it's a simple kind of maneuver to try that may actually save your life. So one of my colleagues brought that up to me. I didn't even think about it originally,
but
I think it's something that everyone needs to be aware of.
We just have about 5 minutes left here, and a couple of things I want to try to do real quick. First, we haven't really talked much at all about what's going on here with U.S. automakers. And one of the news items I wanted to ask you about was late last month, Ford surprised a lot of people by actually declaring a profit, first in 4 years. Is that because of something they're doing right, or are they just benefiting from the fact that other companies are having problems?
Well, in this era, in last year was one of the lowest sales years in U.S. history, going back 20, 30 years. So within that kind of market, Ford was actually able to make a profit. And one of the ways they did that is that they changed the model that they had used and the other manufacturers had used forever, which was considered a push model. They would build vehicles, sell them to the dealers, and then the dealers would have to sell those vehicles. And then they would either put discounts on them or reduce financing. But their goal was to keep making vehicles in the factories and pushing them out and doing whatever it took to sell those vehicles. And they consciously made a decision to say, you know, we're going to try to do a better job of matching our production to demand. So they're only going to build vehicles that they thought they could actually sell. And that was a major difference from what manufacturers had done in the past. Now, it was a little easier to do last year because vehicle sales were so low to start with. You probably weren't making as many vehicles as they had in the past anyhow. Now, the other issue that's connected to this, to Ford being successful, is that they've had some really good success with the types of models that they're building and designing. They've had some very good success with their quality, improved quality, safety ratings, and they've also got a nice set of hybrid vehicles that some of the other manufacturers don't have. So they've been able to do it in controlling their manufacturing, being a little more disciplined in how much they sell, and in also coming out with better vehicles than they had in the past.
One other thing here, and again, we got about 2 minutes, but it's something I know that you're interested in. To what extent do you think that China and maybe also India are going to emerge as major auto manufacturing countries?
Well, China's already a major manufacturing company. It's whether they're going to be exporting those vehicles.
Yeah, okay.
Right now, the market is so hot in China, they're building vehicles just to fulfill the needs of buyers there. And there are so many potential buyers there, you know, it's hard to say when that's going to actually change. And they say, well, let's go outside our borders. India is still growing. They have a lot of people and a lot of potential buyers, and they still need to fulfill the sales for vehicles inside their own country as well before they start exporting. So we'll see. In terms of the potential for them, this is always the question that I get is, you know, when are they coming to the U.S.?
And, yeah.
Not anytime soon. It's going to take a few years before those companies. It's so expensive to become a global company and to be able to have dealerships and aftermarket parts. For every vehicle you put out, you have to provide parts for 15 years for that vehicle, and then also be able to be competitive. Your vehicles have to be competitive against the other vehicles in the market, and if they're not, then they get a really bad reputation, and it takes years to live that down. So it's one of the things we advise the Chinese and the Indians if they're thinking about coming to the U.S.
It just makes you wonder, though, about whether we're moving to a world where in auto manufacturing it's going to be more multipolar and maybe not so much dominated by two or three companies, maybe where they're eventually we get to the point where we have more companies with maybe smaller market share for each of them.
There's potential for that, but those companies then have to be able to manage those companies within that scale. And you know, there's this all these growth demands, especially in the capitalist system, is that the companies need to grow or die kind of thing, and that becomes a problem when you're looking at in the auto industry.
Well, at that, we'll have to finish up. Our guest, Bruce Belzowski, works at the Transportation Research Institute at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He's associate director there, also assistant research scientist in the Automotive Analysis Division's Industry Structure Group. And Mr. Belzowski, thanks very much for being with us.
No problem. Have a good day.